Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. Yes, this show is our fifth anniversary show. 5 years we've been at this. It feels like 5 years too today. But anyway, I've got this cold I'm battling with, but we'll talk more about that later maybe. I'll probably avoid it. So we'll be talking about what's been happening over the past 5 years, looking at some of the latest stats and research on digital banking, where we've come in 5 years. But today's show is brought to you by the Digital Banking Report. The bank and credit union executives and solution providers from more than 300 companies worldwide use insights from the Digital Banking Report to keep pace with digital transformation in financial services. Save $500 off an annual subscription by using the coupon code BREAKINGBANKS, breaking space banks, upon checkout at digitalbankingreport.com. All right, so with me today in the virtual studio is JP Nichols, co-hosting with me today, and joining us also for our fifth anniversary show is our good friend and regular contributor, Jim Morouse. He's publisher of the Digital Banking Report and co-publisher of the Financial Brand. So we'll be launching a new regular segment where Jim will share some of his insights from the research he's published on the, or publishing in the Digital Banking Report. And we're going to start with that today as part of our fifth anniversary show. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, it's great to be back.
So, JP, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me and helping me save my voice from the dreaded lurg today.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've been out of the host chair for a couple of weeks, so I'm still ensconced here in our state-of-the-art West Coast studios. I was ready to take the helm, but glad that you're back. So I want to ask you a couple of questions about the five-year anniversary, but first, okay. I also want to remind everybody that today's show is also sponsored by Provoke Management. The hosts of this and other Provoke.fm shows are some of the world's leading experts in fintech, innovation, and the future of financial services. And you can book them to speak at your conference or organization at provokemanagement.com. So, Brett, I've never asked you this. What was your original goal when you launched the show? 5 years ago, you said, hey, I'm going to launch a podcast. What was the thought behind that?
So podcasts weren't as popular as they are today. So it was a bit of we got ahead of the curve on this. But, to be honest, I was running Banking for Tomorrow, a blog. You guys probably recall that, where I would try and put a blog together.
Sure.
And I'm not like Chris Skinner. I can't churn out a blog post every day.
Yeah, or Jim Maruse.
Or Jim, yeah. With everything that, I've got on, like MoveIn and all this other stuff. So I was trying to find a way to still communicate with the crowd, but not do it where it would take me 3 or 4 hours of research and then, a couple of hours to write a good blog post. Frankly, the show, I thought it's an hour a week. I can do that, and it was an easier format for me. Plus, it enabled me to connect with all these fintech players around the world, interview them, the network that I already had built around fintech, and sort of include that more in a more interactive sort of talk show type format, which is the sort of stuff that I like listening to. So it was both, driven by the fact that I wanted to create a fintech talk show. There really wasn't anything like that at the time.
Right.
And secondly, that I thought it would save me time.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about that. But what surprises did you have along the way? I mean, like what as expected and what was maybe different than you thought 5 years ago?
So I can still remember doing the first show and being super nervous about doing a live radio show and a live broadcast, because I'd never done it before. I mean, I'd done TV and stuff before, but it's the first time I'd hosted something like this. But I didn't think past the first few months. I it was sort of, we'll give this a try for 3 months and see how it goes. If you told me I'd still be on the air 5 years later and we'd have, you know, almost 6 million listeners annually in 150 countries, I'd be like, no way. You know, that's not going to happen. But the other thing that surprised me is I think just some of the quality of the guests that we've had and some of the insights that we've gleaned on the show, and the fact that I've learned a ton out of the show myself, which, you know, has become very important as part of the sort of purpose of the show, was to inform people on what's happening in fintech. And, you know, I consider myself pretty plugged into this stuff, but if I'm learning stuff out of it, then I know the audience is as well. So I think that's sort of been the big, not surprise, but the big win for me, you know, for myself and for the audience out of the show.
Yeah, you know, we've been asking our followers on Twitter to share some of their favorite shows and guests, and also talk about what's changed the most in the past 5 years. I want to ask you and Jim those questions too. What are some of your favorite moments, and what's changed the most or maybe the least in the past 5 years?
Well, I don't think the format's changed that much. I think obviously we've got a lot more, I've brought in a lot more co-hosts and, you know, like yourself, JP, and we've had really strong support from the network over the last few years. You know, the so-called fintech mafia, you know, their input into this has been extremely positive, and I've really enjoyed the diversity of, you know, commentary and so forth we've had on it. But for me personally, I'm a geek at heart. And so the stuff that I've really geeked out on has been like, you know, the sci-fi authors, David Brin, Ram Esnam, you know, when we had Chuck Davidson on talking about mobile for Starbucks and, you know, the launch of that app. You know, I remember that same show we had Gerald Spool on talking about UX. You know, Peter Diamandis from Singularity. We had Elon Musk on, you know, with out of Hong Kong, you know, which Matt Dooley helped us put together. So
yeah, from the Next Money event. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, all this stuff, you know, it's been some really high profile guests, but the stuff that I've really enjoyed, you know, is when we've had guys like Ram Esnam on or Robert Scoble talking about AR and VR and this sort of stuff, and I've just been able to geek out because, you know, that's what I like listening to. So right. Hopefully that's good radio for the audience as well.
Yeah. What about you, Jim?
Excuse me. I think the ones that are most memorable.
You sound like I feel, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the ones that's most memorable obviously is the first time I guest host, because when I guest hosted the first time, I was what I thought was totally prepared until everything went wrong. It was early in the tenure of the podcast. It was in the first year, and I just remember that people were falling off of Skype and all these things were happening. And it was kind of fun because it made me maneuver. It made me go from guest one to guest two immediately to come back to guest one. It sounded seamless when I listened to it afterwards. But I said, man, if you had seen what was going on behind the scenes with me just screaming, going, okay, where am I going now? But I think what's interesting that is the shows I really enjoyed the most were probably the ones you geeked out on. Because when you have a dialogue, when you have the spirited dialogue, when you have somebody like Josh Reich or something like that who you know well, and the hour goes by in a second, it's fun because as a listener, you sit there and you go, man, I got more. And there is no, yeah. And so you just listen to it more times. But I think, you know, what's really interesting is you have so many guests that have done so many unique things. You're not in a single lane. You're in a directionally the same, but you have a lot of variety, and you never know what's going to pop up and what's going to be next. But everything from blockchain, and you mentioned it, to the whole thing of AI and VR with Scopel and all that was a blast. And again,
yeah. Did you guys listen to the Ben Goetzel show we did Christmas last year? You know, the creator of Sophia. All that sort of stuff is really, you know, that stuff's great. But, Jim, to your point, you know, some of the shows also I think that have had the best dynamic have been shows where, you know, you've come on. We've had Chris Skinner, Dave Birch. Dave's always hilarious to have on the show. Some of the funniest moments we've had on the show have been with Birch.
Definitely.
I remember one time in particular, we were doing this news item, and it was about the Yahoo hack. do you guys remember that moment? And, you know, we were saying, and I was reading out the news and I said, you know, Yahoo has been hacked and, you know, they say up to 500 million people, you know, 500 million people could have been affected by this hack. And Dave jumps in with, I'm shocked. I'm really shocked. And I'm like, where's he going with this? You know? And he says, I had no idea Yahoo still had 500 million users on their platform.
And they probably didn't. I think they just have a database of five million. Yeah.
And we all just cracked up. I think that was probably one of the funniest moments, but he's always great to have on the show. But you know, those shows where we have, you know, the end of year or start of year summary shows, you know, the future vision stuff, you know, combined with what you do, Jim, on the print side or the digital print side. You know, when we do those end of year or, you know what's going to happen this year in fintech shows and we have those sorts of personalities on, those shows always tend to get the most feedback from me in places like LinkedIn where people will be sending me messages going, I love that show you guys did last week. And so from an audience feedback perspective, it backs up what you're saying, Jim, that those really conversational shows with our regulars, who everyone sort of knows through the network because they're very visible fintech people, those shows tend to be, I think, probably the best.
You know,
it's almost like a cocktail party where you think you're all around the same table, and you get Shevlin to get into it with Birch, and you get it with myself or JP, and you have this dialogue that goes on. It goes on with many other times that are not recorded, thank goodness. But, you know, when we're all getting together, but it's a blast. And it, you know, it doesn't have to include me, obviously, because I enjoy listening probably more than the interaction. But there's been so many really good shows where you get the feeling also that the guests didn't want to get off the show, that they had a lot more they wanted to talk about.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the statistics and the feedback, I think you're right. Those are some of the most popular shows. But for me as a listener, I actually enjoyed hearing about the people I'd never heard of before. I've never heard of this person, and you find out how interesting, how smart, what cool things they're doing. And I've met so many new people and learned so many new companies and apps. Now, as a host, my favorite moments are as you know, I like to tell stories. And so I like when we really get to dig deep with somebody. I'm thinking that show that we did at Startup Bootcamp a couple of years ago now, that was really one of the first kind of produced, recorded shows that we had done. It wasn't just open the mics and talk. And we got to deep dive with three different startups and talk about their journey. And then we went out to Plug and Play in California and did a similar thing during their demo day. So I always like the chance to dive a little bit deeper with somebody and get behind the headlines.
Well, you know, in terms of production value stuff, probably the M-Pesa show we did in Kenya as well, when I was on the ground there. Yeah. That was, I think, and Jim, you were heavily involved in that as well. You know, and that was a show that really, we've been talking about M-Pesa in the vernacular, you know, for a couple of years, but being on the ground, actually walking into a store using M-Pesa to transact and hearing a merchant in downtown Nairobi talking about the fact that, you know, 60 to 70% of their transactions were M-Pesa and people trust M-Pesa more than cash. You know, that moment was really powerful, I think, for me as a host, you know, being there on the ground, seeing it. So, but, you know, also, you know, we've been breaking news stuff, you know, some of the breaking news stuff, you know, early on with Ripple and TransferWise and, you know, John Stein from Betterman and all these things, you know, that we were able to do. You know, I think, you know, you look back at the content of this, apart from the crazy, amazing guests we've had on, you know, Diamandis, Boris Johnson, Elon Musk, Guy Kawasaki, you know, all these amazing people. You know, I think the fact that we've sort of been at the heart of the fintech space for 5 years now is a real credit to everyone involved. And, you know, at this point, I think probably it's worthwhile, JP, giving a shout out to Rachel Morrissey as well, who, you know, was with us as producer for most of those 5 years and really helped us out and, you know, put the stuff together there too.
Absolutely. She's a tremendous storyteller and producer. And, you know, one thing I would add, though, to all of this is, it's funny you mentioned TransferWise. I literally just 1 hour ago had a conversation with a very savvy CFO that used TransferWise for the first time ever, had no idea it existed. And I continue to raise M-Pesa in the classroom and talks that I have with bankers, they've never heard of it. It's 10 years old at this point. So while you are always pushing the very cutting edge of the envelope, I think it's also important to remember we've got a lot of listeners out there that this stuff is still new to them. Some of the things that are really old hat. We're going to talk today about, you know, what's changed and what hasn't, I think, you know, as our listenership has grown, we've got to keep in mind it's not all cutting edge geeks like you guys. We've got a lot of people out there that are really trying to not only learn things, but put them into practice.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think it's important if you're going to do something like this for 5 years, you have to enjoy it as well. So, the stuff that we enjoy, obviously, Jim, you know, you'd agree with this. The stuff we like talking about is the stuff that, you know, we can learn from as well. All right. So, JP, we're going to cover some news. I guess we should, right?
Yeah, we should. When we have some conference announcements, too.
So we'll get to the conference announcements.
I'll start next week on May 7th. Jason Henricks is going to be debuting a new talk, The Future Belongs to the Cyborg. He's at the Formula Folios Doing Good conference in Austin. We're seeing a lot of interest in wealth management coming up. And I know, you know, that was a big part of my background. And early on, we kind of talked about where fintech was going to go in wealth management. And I think there's still a long way to go. And so we're starting to see a big uptick there.
The augmented banker, yes. Okay, May 8th and 11th, we've got, of course, Finovate Spring in San Jose, Silicon Valley. JP Nichols, Ron Shevlin, Theo Lau will all be speaking at Finovate Spring on Thursday. If you want a discount for Finovate Spring, there's still time. If you haven't bought your tickets yet, we have the inside track on that. So DM myself or JP Nichols and we will get you sorted.
Yeah. Also next week, Jim, you're going to be out in Las Vegas with the Financial Brand Forum. So what a great job, Jeffrey
Pelcher. It's going to be huge this year, right? Huge.
Yeah. How many people are you expecting?
They're going to be over 1,750, which, you know, it's the fifth year of its existence, and it's grown every year by more than 20 to 25%. And this is doing it all on the backs of the bankers, as we say, because Jeffrey is unique in that fact that he limits the number of vendors at the event to about 22% so that you don't have a 50-50 or worse split, and nobody feels like they're not getting enough attention or getting too much attention for that. But we're running out of space. I mean, he sold out this year, and there may be a couple tickets left, but for the most part, he sold all the spots he had. And 3-day event. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and we got, you know, you mentioned Guy Kawasaki, Brett, and he's going to be speaking there as is Randy Zuckerberg, and Brian Solis, and just a number of other people that are just...
And, of course, Jim, you're going to be speaking there as well, right?
I am going to be speaking, yep.
So we'll look forward to that. Is it going to be streamed, or is it just going to be recorded and showed later?
They're actually going to record all the sessions. And people who show up are going to be getting free access to all the sessions that they bought, what they called a gold pass. And early registrants also got access to that. But I know that he's looking to distribute that as well, because it's going to be the first time that I think every session is going to be recorded.
Fantastic. So May 7th, I'll be in New York at the Four Seasons. I'll be speaking for Verizon Enterprise to their financial services clients there. It is an invitation-only event, but if you really want to come, like, contact me. I'll see what I can do. May 15 to 16, I'll be in the Netherlands for the NRC Live Transformative Fintech event. You can check it out at nrclive.nl/fintech.
Well, on the 19th and 20th of May is FinFounder. That's FinFounder. It's about female founders. And it's put on by our friends, Kristen Theory and Holly Glowati. They were on the show a few weeks ago talking about their Flourish branded currency conference. But this is a 2-day immersive workshop for women-led startups to learn from industry experts and investors to accelerate their company's growth and fundraising. It's May 19th and 20th in Chicago. And we have a promo code for that. Use BANKS1. To save 40%. So go to FinFounder, that's FinFounder.com for details.
And American Bankers Digital Banking Conference in Austin, Texas is on June 6th to 8th. 650 plus senior level executives from financial institutions, credit unions, CUs, solution providers from the U.S. and elsewhere will be there. And it's going to be a great 3-day event. See if you can join us there.
Well, you can tell it is conference season because I have even one more.
So yeah, it is.
FinTech Week's coming up the 6th through 13th of July in London, where the world of FinTech comes to the world's FinTech capital to enhance the dialogue between established multinationals, innovation firms, disruptive startups, governments, media, investors, and more. So FinTech Week in London, July 6th through 13th.
You know, JP, I was talking with Jay about this, and you probably observed this, and Jim, you know, yourself as well, is that, you know, April, May, October, November, those are the big conference months consistently. Yes. You know, as a speaker, I find that's when I'm busiest throughout the year.
Yes.
You know, that's when the demand is up. You know, it's a pretty simple reason why. People want to get their conferences done before the summer and before Christmas, you know, or before the summer break if you're in the Northern Hemisphere.
That's right.
So that's sort of the timing of this stuff. But listen, if you've got an event you want to share with the audience, let us know. Hit us up on Twitter, you know, at BreakingBanks1, or email us at info@provoke.fm, and we'll be happy to talk about it. Now, in the news, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we want to get through. We're going to be talking about payments in a minute, but I don't know whether you guys saw, well, lots of news about Square and their Bitcoin trading business. We're going to get to that in a moment. But BBVA, their VC fund, has invested in a new Brazilian challenger bank called Neon. I don't know whether you guys saw that, because their venture capital arm is called Propel. So that made an investment in that that bank, Neon. They claim about 600,000 customers right now in Brazil. And so far, they've raised $22 million for this two-year-old challenger bank based out of Brazil. So that's pretty exciting. But we have been talking the last 5 years. We've talked consistently about payment space. And this continues to get a lot of news. There was a Great American Banker article on this, particularly in respect to China, where the change in mobile payments in China, which is, you know, we've been talking about this consistently. Chris was speaking about it with Digital Human, his book launch the other week. But it's just changed the dynamic so much there. In fact, one of the recent stats that's come out that it potentially could change up to 40% of the deposit market because of the change in payments behavior there. So it's really representing a pretty significant shift in behavior and a risk to the incumbents in the market. But with China doing $12 trillion U.S. dollars worth of mobile payments last year, and the U.S. doing about $170 billion, so almost one one-hundredth of what China's doing, you know, the U.S. is probably a few, you know, maybe 3-5 years behind China today, at least a couple of years behind Europe as well. So with the what's happening in the U.S., Bank Innovation reported this week that right now only 7 banks are connected to the clearinghouse's real-time payments platform. That's Citi, Chase, Bank New York Mellon, U.S. Bank, SunTrust, BB&T, and PNC. And as the discussion speaks about in the American Banker article, we've been talking about real-time payments since 2015, yet PNC, who's the third bank to go live with this first phase of real-time payments, they won't actually be live in the market until 2019. So, you know, even despite the fact that we're talking about this all the time, and we've been talking about it since the show started back in 2013, you know, we're going to get to 2019, that's 6 years, since we've been talking about faster payments, and we still won't be live with the majority of banks in the U.S.
Well, it's a big challenge for the U.S. banks, and part of the issue is cost. I mean, they already have the legacy systems, unlike China. So the Fed and the Clearinghouse study that set this whole thing up talked about total costs somewhere between $4 and $7 billion. So there's a lot of wait and see, and especially from the smaller banks. And of course, very much related to that then is, how do you figure out what the payoff of that investment's really going to be? And why do I care as a, you know, community bank in the U.S. what's happening in China? So I think it's still a big challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to check that out, go to bankinnovation.net. The title of the article is What's Holding Up Real-Time Payments, but also check out the American Banker article. Jim, you retweeted that yesterday, right? The one on Chinese payments?
Sure did.
So we'll put it out on the Breaking Banks feed, both of those articles, so you guys can get a look at that as well. But all right, JP.
Well, I know we wrapped up blockchain month last week, but Ripple is in the news this week. And we've got an interesting interview coming up with Ripple soon. But Finextra is reporting that Standard Charter has announced that they're extending their use of RippleNet to more countries. Now, they announced last year that they want to use Ripple to unlock the $15 billion trade corridor between India and Singapore. And now they're planning to use the Ripple network for cross-border payments to five more pairs of countries over the coming year.
Yeah, well, in Singapore, of course, you know, fintech is hot, and their intellectual property office has a new initiative to speed up the patent process called the Fintech Fast Track. So they also announced some new artificial intelligence initiative recently. But if you're, you know, if you're familiar with the patent process, this process can take up to 2 years initially, you know, or typically, but they're saying they can get this down to 6 months. So this would include patents on blockchain applications to improve, you know, safety, security, efficiency of clearing and settlement, you know, trading, transaction payments, patents, and so forth. So you can check that out at the MAS, the Intellectual Property Office, and bcfocus.com has a news item on it.
Well, you know, last thing that caught my eye, and I know we're going to head to break here shortly. So, Jim, I want you to cue up your thoughts thinking about this. Finextra also reported on the J.D. Power survey that said that digital-only customers were less satisfied than those that use branches. And then obviously those that use both were the even more satisfied. And I think there's a lot of discussion to be had about what that means and what that doesn't mean. Brad, I know you have some thoughts about that. So.
Well, let's jump straight into that, because before the break, I'd like to get into that. So, Jim, you know, what did you recently report on in respect to mobile banking engagement for the big banks? What's happening there?
Yeah, in one of the research reports that's been done, we looked at all the industry reports. We found that the big banks are continually growing their engagement on mobile banking, and they do it aggressively. They don't, you know, unfortunately, a lot of institutions that we watch, the smaller organizations tend to build it and hope they will come. And the big banks aren't sitting still. They continue to innovate. Bank of America just, I think there's an innovation every week of some sort on their mobile banking platform. They're continually promoting it. They're continually trying to work on engagement. And I think what's interesting is they realize that the digital consumer, yes, it saves them money, but the engagement level needs to be enhanced. They have to get better at it, and there's a bigger demand. The digital consumer is digital in everything they do. So what happens is, if a bank does not perform well in the digital, if they do not have, let's say, a new account opening using a mobile channel, consumers just shake their head and go, I can get this on Amazon. I can get this other ways. And the big banks right now are really setting themselves further and further apart from the masses of organizations in their ability to answer the needs of the digital consumer. And one thing, a study that we did, we found that the highest percentage of millennials are now opening accounts at the major banks, even if they're not local. So if a person will open the bank with a Wells Fargo, with a Bank of America, with a PNC or something like that, even if they're not in their marketplace, because it gives them a better experience. And these are millennials that in normal will say, I mean, this weekend's a big weekend. It's a small business week. So you have a situation. These people want to do business locally, but they're not going to set their bank account in a situation that does not have the modern conveniences of what a digital bank should have.
So, you know, to talk to that, there's some really interesting data. I know you've looked at it, but I looked at it also in Bank 4.0. And, you know, back in 2000, the top eight banks in the U.S. had about, in terms of asset base or deposit base, about 22% of the market. Today, it's 67%. So that talks to your argument, Jim, that I think that, you know, you're seeing deposit action move specifically along with those who have the most advanced digital platforms. I think that's a pretty consistent thing that we're seeing globally, is that the digital players are tending to get, you know, more engagement. Now, you can have digital plus branch, that's fine, but the guys with the biggest branch networks also tend to have the most sophisticated digital platforms, right?
Well, you know, Brett, you know, it's interesting because you went to the White House, as did I, and we were asked, you know, they were telling us, number one, that they can't continue to protect the smaller banks from themselves. And I think, you know, this growth is not being caused by mergers and acquisitions. This is by consumers making a choice where they want to go bank. It's the free market system playing itself out in the digital world. And that's concerning because, you know, yeah. I think there's a great place for small and mid-sized banks, but you've got to provide the basics of what a consumer wants, or the consumer will shop with their wallet and with their mobile phone.
Well, Ron just chimed in on Twitter, Ron Shevlin. He said, consumers can't do everything in digital channels. Banks have not built out every interaction on digital channels. So many digitally-only consumers have to use another channel that they would prefer not to use, and that translates into less satisfied. I think he's got a point there. I think, you know, there's no universal banking model for digital at this point. You know, it tends to be chunks of functionality, and so people are using different apps for different things. Having said that, I think that that's just probably the way it will develop in terms of experience. I don't think you're going to Jim, do you think consumers are looking for a one-stop shop with everything on digital like they used to with universal banks?
Not necessarily one-stop shop, but people are becoming wise. So what happened is you can't, in many cases, banks will say they're digital and they will take digital applications for loans, or they'll take digital account opening. But invariably, you have to go to a branch to finish part of it. So you disengage, and many times you're getting re-engaged on a manual channel where the branch employee is incented to start the whole process over again. But you know, I found that I got so frustrated with the refinance process that I decided to use Rocket Mortgage, and more and more people are saying there's got to be a better alternative because they know in other interactions they can. But, you know, a consumer does not go from corner to corner to corner shopping for a new bank now. They do it all digitally, and then they engage initially digitally, and somewhere in that process, the bank's going to let them down because in, you know, 80%, 90% of the choices, they're going to get in a situation where they say, oh, by the way, you still have to go to the branch to bring a check in, or you still have to know your customer, or you still have to use e-signatures or make your deposit in the branch. And that's breaking the trust and the engagement that you thought was going to happen when you started the process.
Yeah, Jim, you're absolutely right. And I want you to hang on after the break, too, because I think we have a lot more to say about this. But we do need to take a short break, and I want to acknowledge another sponsor. Brett, you know a little bit about this. One of today's sponsors is Moovin. Moovin is the world's first downloadable bank account, and it's changing the way people engage with their money. Learn how Moovin is helping banks drive customer acquisition and deeper engagement at Moovin.com. And we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks after this.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey, you're back with Brett King and JP Nichols and Jim Morales for our fifth year anniversary show. You know, we couldn't put this show together without support of sponsors and partners in this. So we want to reach out and thank the Financial Revolutionist, which has been named one of the best tech newsletters by Business Insider. They're written each week by their co-founder, Greg Schoenberg. It's been referred to as the fintech newsletter that's not just about fintech. That's because in addition to fintech, Financial Revolutionist touches on a wide range of financial innovation topics, including politics, healthcare, changing nature of the workforce, history, pop culture, and so forth. So check them out. They're a great sponsor of ours, a supporter of ours. So go to www.thefr.com. That's thefinancialrevolutionist.com. Now, we've been talking with Jim Morales about mobile banking trends. Jim, what else did you find in respect to the trends that we should be taking note of?
Well, we also recently had an article that we wrote about Citibank's foray into the brand new digital bank that they're building. And it's completely different than other things we've seen in the U.S. where it's really going to be almost like a bank plus mint that is open platform for not only their customers, but for non-customers.
Who thought that it'd be a good idea to build financial wellness into a basic smart bank account. I wonder who thought about that idea.
Yeah, maybe we should get that guy from Movin' on to talk about that.
but it's unique in that, Citibank has the least amount of overhead with regard to branches in the U.S. and actually internationally for such a big bank.
And Jim, remember when that was considered a weakness?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And now, you know, they're able to build from scratch in a rather relatively quick way, but they're building it just completely differently. You know, Brett, you and I saw the person from Citibank in New York a couple weeks ago talk about their decision to build a platform that really was using open banking and APIs in a completely different way, where it's not just for their own customers, but for non-customers as well, where you can get a lot of the benefits of the relationship. And you know, people first ask, is this going to be something that's going to just be a way to bombard the people that are non-customers for Citibank account? They said, no, we're building the mechanism in place to make sure that we use AI and advanced learning to limit the amount of contact we have unless the person, you know, indicates that they need something. And I think when we look at the possibility of new challenger banks coming into the U.S. and we look at the way that the whole industry is transforming right now, that's pretty much the way it seems to be going, in that you're going to bring best-of-class solutions together in an ecosystem that's going to be very different from what the ecosystem looks like today. And, you know, Brett said it for a while, people don't necessarily look for a bank, they look for banking. And they may not even look for banking, they may just look for integrated ways to make my life easier.
So I'll give you some extra insight into this in terms of some of the stats that I've been watching in this respect. To that point, you know, Ron just clarified regarding that that report. Ron just sent me a DM on this. Actually, he tweeted it out as well. He said that if you look at that report in terms of mobile versus branch engagement and the data that we saw on that, it's not an endorsement. It shouldn't be interpreted as an endorsement for branches, because if you look at it, we are having a demonstrable shift in customer behavior. And all that report shows is that, you know, digital players have to do better with engagement. But here's the interesting thing is if you look at data, 1995, the average American visited a bank branch 26 times a month, right? In 2008, that was 4 to 5 times a year. This year, for the majors, it's going to be less than once a year for the majority of their customers, Right? Mm. So this is an undeniable trend. We just don't simply need to go to the branch as much as we used to. Now, that means that in terms of cross-sell, upsell, revenue engagement through the branch, it is definitely less effective than it was. So you now will have side-by-side challenger banks and then incumbents who've started up their digital efforts. So, you know, Finn through Chase, Greenhouse, Wells Fargo, you know, Citibank with their initiative, plus the challenger banks who are already doing this, Digital Direct with, purpose-built engagement on digital. And then you're going to have the branch model of engagement as the alternative. I think it's not going to be too long before market analysts are looking at the data and saying, if you haven't right-sized your branch networks and you're carrying excess branch stock, then you're not going to be getting bang for your buck in respect to, you know, ROAE and return on those assets, because people aren't going to be using the branches. They're not buying stuff in the branches, and so the economics are changing.
They're less productive assets.
I'm sorry, you guys know I'm passionate about this, right? I will state for the record once again. Everyone thinks I'm death of branch guy. Branches will be here for, decades to come. But the economics of branch banking, it's only the very, very best performing branches will survive this.
Well, one thing I love about Ron Shevlin is even when he's not on the show, he's on the show. And he also talked about in his Cornerstone Advisors Insight Vault, he had a great quote in there. Checking accounts have become paycheck motels, temporary places for people's money to stay before it moves on to bigger and better places. And so the broader point being, and something he's been talking about for a long time, it's not just implications on the branch model, it's implications on your product model. And you've got to rethink the whole product and the features and benefits of those products.
Yeah. So listen, Jim,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
We've just got a few minutes left before we go to an interview I recorded when I was in Tokyo last week. But before we do that, and it's with Jessica Tan from Ping An, next week we want to get you back on the show talking about banking and fintech partnerships, and you've done some research on that. Can you give us a quick preview on what you're working on, so we can talk about it on the upcoming shows?
Well, I think. In a nutshell, and I try to do everything in a nutshell, but it doesn't come out that way. But basically, there's a lot more collaboration going on. Traditional banks are looking at the fintechs as a way to speed up innovation, speed up technology, and really start providing services outside of what they normally do that are branch-based. And I think what we have found that overall, the collaboration, they're not seen as competitors much as collaborators right now, and banks of all sizes are really making headway. And I know JP, you and Brett have both seen this internationally, that more and more banks are partnering in some way or form to say, how can we provide what these organizations can provide our customers quickly.
Yeah, okay. So tell us a little bit about what you're talking about at Financial Brand Forum next week.
Basically, it's going to be about innovation in banking, but at the end, since they're mostly bank markers, the leaving thoughts are going to be that change is going to happen, you need to embrace it, that anything you knew how to do last year is going to be just basically uprooted in the coming year, and that you're going to have to embrace change, take risks, which is not a bank forte, and disrupt yourself. And that if you do not move forward and change what your specialty is on an ongoing basis, you're going to be outplaced either physically or certainly mentally.
Adaptability. It's absolutely key. Yep. Well, Jim, look, thanks for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. Obviously, we'll have you back, maybe not next week because you've got Financial Brand Forum on, but as soon as we can, we'll have you back to give us more goodness from the research on the digital banking report. And right now, what I'd like to do to close out today's show is we have an interview that I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Jessica Tan. She's the Deputy Group CEO and the head of the CIO and head of innovation for Ping An Group, the largest insurance group in China. And, the numbers that she's talking about, hundreds of millions of customers and agents and so forth, it just blows me away. So while we're in Tokyo a couple of weeks ago, I recorded this interview with Jessica Tan. Let's roll the interview. Thanks, Matt.
All right, guys, so we are here actually in Tokyo, but I'm visiting with Jessica Tan, who's the group CEO, CIO. What's your official
Deputy title? Group CEO.
Deputy group CEO of Ping An. But you also run the incubator, One Connect, and you run their innovation initiatives. Is that a fair?
Yes, that's right. So let me maybe describe a bit what Ping An Group is and what my role is. So Ping An Group is really we are the largest integrated financial services institution in China. We started off as an insurance company, but we've now expanded from insurance, banking, securities, etc. What's unique about us is two things. We are known. One is that we have a lot of agents. In total, we have 1.8 million agents, 1.8 million employees with 1.3 million agents. And the other thing that we're known for is actually our technology. So we've been very aggressive for the past 10 years in investing in technology, particularly in fintech and health tech. We invest about 1% of our revenues on R&D every year. So last year amounts to be about $1.1 billion. This year we invest $1.5 billion. And we really believe that investing technology, not just used in our core financial services business, but we offer that as a technology companies, we incubate that to the rest of the ecosystems, right? To other banks and insurance companies, to other hospitals, government, etc. And I have a very exciting role. So I'm one of our deputy group CEOs. I have two roles within the company. One role is really to incubate, grow, and manage large part of our portfolio of new businesses. We have about 11 of them over the past 7 years. My other role is at the group CEO and CIO for our 32 subsidiaries within the group.
Now, when we were speaking about this earlier, you talked about the fact that just in the space of P2P lending, there's over 4,000 P2P lenders in China. But you also talk about the fact that, you're acting as sort of a platform for services like blockchain as a service and things like that. So how does Ping An see its role in, both incubating and encouraging fintechs? Because it doesn't look like you see fintechs as a threat, you see it as an opportunity. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, that's right. I think we believe fintech not just as an internet-based company that tries to do financial services. We see fintech as more broadly, right, as new technologies that can actually help financial institutions and non-financial institutions do their front, middle, back office much better, right? So things that we would do includes biometrics, artificial intelligence applied to risk management in various areas, cloud, and as you said, blockchain. So in blockchain in particular, we are not so interested in the cryptocurrency aspects of it. We're much more interested in the underlying blockchain. So starting about 3 years ago, we started to look at the underlying distributed ledger technology, what can be used in financial services and health context, right? So we made a couple of changes to make it palatable to scale. So I'll give two examples. First thing we did was to make it scalable. Right? As you know, the traditional cryptocurrency, particularly in the context of Bitcoin, it's deliberately made such that you have to mine for things, that's a bit of scalability issue. So we made some tweaks to it such that we can scale a simple server, a home server, can actually run up to 10,000 transactions per second, right? So we now can scale significantly. Second thing we made the difference is that in a lot of financial services transactions, you need the validation, but privacy too. So we have various patents on this what we call zero knowledge proof, whereby different nodes can actually validate that your transaction is valid without knowing who the transacting parties are, what asset they are transacting, and how much they're transacting. And that has really helped us to grow a lot. So right now, our blockchain as a service nodes, we have about 22,000 nodes in production. We have about 200 institutions participating in this transaction. Last year alone, we have about 12 trillion RMB in transactions on these notes live, and we're quite very excited about that.
So you talked about 22,000 nodes on this. So what flavor of blockchain are you using? Using NAM, using Ethereum, Hyperledger? What's the blockchain technology underlying this?
Yeah, so we use Hyperledger, and then on top of Hyperledger, we've created another layer to make the changes that I mentioned such that we think it will scale up nicely for financial services and health in various contexts. So that's how we would do it. And then on top of it, we developed applications in a couple of areas, financial services being one of them. We use it for trade finance. We use it for inter-institutional trading. We use it for credit lending. And then beyond financial services, we extend it to others. So with trade finance, we're now extending. We're working with customs and suppliers to try and put the whole supply chain process onto blockchain. We're working with hospitals in terms of health records and governments on housing registry. All right. So we see, you know, really three layers: a core blockchain as a service layer, which makes all these provision of services with the tweaks that I mentioned much easier. We see a second layer whereby, you know, there's really a transaction level where the financial institutions play a huge role, right? Because when any blockchain, you're really trying to unify the three flows, right? The information flow, the goods flow, and the cash flow, right? And once you touch cash, et cetera, you have the financial services layer. And then on top of that, the third layer is really then the different scenarios or ecosystem whereby you have to really work into the real economy with the government, with the other market participants to adopt the same kind of protocol, if you will, right? So that's when they extend into trade, customs, housing, health, et cetera. And our hope is that we open this up so that more and more people can get to use this, because the benefits really come when more folks use this, right? We ourselves are just one player in the market.
So you're big on identity on the blockchain. Obviously, you guys are doing transactional stuff. But tell me, you know, like with the stuff you're doing with customs and the stuff you're doing with the housing registry, do you see the advantage for blockchain in terms of tracking these assets or managing these assets lends itself to the insurance business? You know, the blockchain, do you think that's going to help mm-hmm. you on the insurance mm-hmm. side?
I think it's going to take sometime. We see this as really three levels of evolution. The first level is really just getting the information on the chain itself, such that it's immutable and there's a valid, simple record that everybody has instead of a central registry. I think that just makes the information asymmetry, I mean, remove these inefficiency. I think the second level is when you make the block more smarter, which I think a lot of people talk about smart contract. But in these days, there are very few which are truly smart in some sense. I think we're beginning to do that in some areas. So for example, we have one of the applications with a bank on diamond trading, right? So the first level, we really just record what the different attributes of the diamonds are, the clarity and all the kind of stuff that all goes like.
Is this like Everledger? Or?
Yes, that's right. Something. We work actually with them okay. on that, but we do it in China. Then the second level, if you want to make it smart, you got to start thinking about what are some of the actions that they can do or not, right? So in our institutional platform, I mentioned in some of the asset, you know, there are different terms about is underlying asset, right? What part of it can be collateralized or not collateralized? There'll be terms, and we're trying now, you know, very painstakingly going through the legal terms, matching the product structure with the legal terms, with the process, with the block itself, right? And that's really making it smarter, right? So that it's just not a record of information, but it's actually smarter in determining what actions it is, right? If you do coding, I used to do like object-oriented coding. This is like back in the days where, you know, this is like an object and you determine what actions it can do. So that's really the second stage. And then after second stage, do we then believe then there's a true third stage whereby it transcends, you know, as you, do more, you can actually then, to your question about, you know, let's say if I have a a record on the car, which we are trying to do a pilot on, you know, eventually it links to insurance. It links to you doing the secondhand car selling because you know this car has been damaged twice in an accident, repaired at this particular shop and changed these parts, right? But only when you have done levels one and two, do you really get that transaction flow in the whole ecosystems and you get the benefits, right? So it will take a long time, which is why we took it upon this effort, you know, not looking at the short term. We believe it's just like how when internet started, it takes a while to get everyone on it, but we can see the potential in it, which is why we're very willing to invest and work with everyone to get there. And hopefully, you know, in my lifetime, I'll see level three.
So you give a great sales pitch about China's progress in the fintech space and innovation more generally. But, you know, we don't hear a lot about it in the West because it's a bit of a huge closed-loop ecosystem in many respects. But where can people find out more about what Ping An's doing if they're interested? Because I personally, my thesis is China's way ahead of the U.S. on some of these fintech things right now. So yeah. How can we find out more about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, I think China fintech was very blessed in the past 5-7 years. I'm very blessed to have been part of it. I think for a couple of reasons. One is that it's still a growing market, unlike many parts of the global financial institutions where growth has slowed down and margins are slim, right? So market in China is still growing. Number two is that we were blessed also with the consumer, the whole market itself, consumers were just really aware of the internet and the mobile, right? So we have, you know, it's not just in financial services, it's in everywhere. And then the third one is that regulatory-wise, they've been quite open and experimenting. So we've been blessed with that. We're very happy. For Ping An, you could go to, we have these investor days, we've been trying. I think in the past, we've just been focused on doing and not really talking about this. Last year, we started to have these group investor days whereby we share a lot about what we do and in quite full details. That's actually webcast on the PowerPoint on our official website and you can look at it. I think we did once in May last year and November last year and you know hopefully you can look at it and your audience can look at it and give us a lot of comments. It's still very much a work in progress but we are very excited about the prospects.
Jessica, thanks very much for your time and all the continued success with your efforts at Ping An.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's fantastic to see you again in Tokyo and please come. We'd love to host you anytime you're in Shenzhen or Shanghai.
Absolutely. Xiexie.
That was Brett King with Jessica Tan from Ping An, recorded a couple of weeks ago in Tokyo. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks again to Jim Marouche from the Digital Banking Report. And remember, you can save $500 off of an annual subscription by using the code BREAKINGBANKS on checkout. And if you like the show, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show, helps us get new listeners. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 200 shows, plus episodes from FinTech 5 with Jason Hendricks, my show Serial Entrepreneur, and Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. Next week, I'll be speaking at Finovate in Silicon Valley along with Ron Shevlin and Theo Lau and a whole host of our friends. But we'll be back again next week. I think Brett will be back in the driver's seat along with Jason Hendricks. So we'll be back next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.